Hello and welcome to the Creating Crowbar. Today is Tuesday the 18th of March and this is episode 34. I'm Graham Smith and I'm joined here by Marsh Davies.
Hello.
And Chris Thurston.
Hi.
And then that's it. It's just the three of us today because this week is GDC, which means the two Toms are off having a miserable time in horrible San Francisco with all the horrible not cool people, not at all going to parties and having a great time and wishing they were back here in Somerset where everything's great.
In my bedroom.
Yeah. Everyone wishes they were in your bedroom, Chris.
Yeah, that's where the real GDC is. Just don't ask what any of those letters stand for. Sorry for ruining everyone's night.
Yeah, we just...
And so early as well.
Has there been any news? It seems like it's been a quiet GDC this time. Like, I was expecting a few more announcements than there's been thus far.
I haven't seen any kind of real buzz yet, but I guess it has just started. Like, I know in Tom Senior's case, from working with him on Gamer, that he's, I think, just, like, peeled himself off a plane and into a hotel and is getting started. So at this point at which we're recording, it's probably quite difficult to get a tone for the event. A lot of people making fun of the free-to-play game summit, which happens, I think, at the same time, but is part of GDC proper, but is sort of its own enterprise as well, which does sound very funny. Lots of great conference, like, you know, titles for seminars, like How to Monetize Teens and the emotions of microtransactions and things like that. I don't think microtransactions feel emotions, but if they did, that emotion would probably be, fuck you.
I went to Casual Connect, which is a conference
in
Seattle. Yeah, which is all about casual games. So basically Facebook games. And this was in their real heady heights in around 2010 or so, when Kinazinga had just floated. And, you know, it had conference talk, seminar talks like how to build your own zombie army was one of them, about how, you know, your monetization strategy could sucker people in.
Oh, the
psychological tricks
are people.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Right. That's charming.
Yeah, it was great. It was a pretty good show. But, like, GDC is a weird conference because I've only been once and it's really laid back compared to something like E3, which is obviously all about selling. Mm. But you do also get, just because there are lots of press in GDC, a few announcements there. So, like, Battlefield 4 was shown at GDC for the first time.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that, actually. I remember you seeing it for the first time because it was the Bonnie Tyler thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. They're kind of like 9-minute-long video thing that we all had to queue for. Everyone was told you're not allowed to take any photos of it. Sign this contract thing, you won't take any photos of it. If you take photos of it, we'll sue you. And then while we were sat in the audience waiting for the video to start, someone on their phone noticed that the trailer had appeared online, and they were streaming the trailer on using laptops, you know, in the free Wi-Fi for this trailer that we weren't allowed to take even still photos of.
Good job, everybody involved.
Yeah, that was great. Well, if you've been to GDC, Marsh.
Yeah, a couple of times. There were a couple. I can't remember what was announced the year size there. David Cage is always doing stuff and showboating there. That's my main memory of it. I think that was the big reveal. Actually, not
David Cage.
In as much as he is kind of synonymous with his games, always revealing himself.
They're making a new David Cage. David Cage 3.
I wish they would.
Heavy Rain.
Yeah, he always has a tech demo to reveal. I don't know. Wonder if he's turning up this year.
I don't know. What have you been playing this week, Chris?
I have been playing the Heroes of the Storm, which is Blizzard's, formerly Blizzard All-Stars, formerly Blizzard Dota. So much so, in fact, that some of the files associated with it are still called Blizzard Dota, which is amusing. So I've been playing it. I appreciate I've talked about it on the podcast before when I got back from BlizzCon. At BlizzCon, I played it quite a lot, mostly against bots, because that was available to the press readily, and once or twice with other people. And I've had, since Friday last week, access to the internal alpha alongside a wave of a small number of other press, some sort of players who kind of won the beta lottery. And strangely, maybe not strangely, a lot of Dota 2 community people. Like, a lot of pro players, a lot of, like, the sort of popular YouTubers and whatever, specifically for Dota 2, were given access as well. And that's been a really interesting experience, because I liked the game from what I played a bit of BlizzCon, what they've done, to reiterate, people maybe didn't hear what we were talking about last time, is take that formula of pushing lanes and leveling up a hero and killing creeps and stuff, and simplify it to the extent that it's very difficult to screw up so badly that your team is utterly, utterly ruined for the sake of the rest of the game. It's the kind of, you know, it takes away items, gold, individual experience bars, the vast majority of the leveling decisions you'd ever make, and gives a game that it focuses pretty much chiefly on, two teams fighting and making strategic decisions about where they're going on the map and what objectives they're going to complete. And there's two ways of looking at that. One is just that it is like Duplo Dota, which is kind of sometimes how it feels.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. And the other is that actually, you know, for some reason it feels good to you is that it's an accessible take on a formula that does alienate people. There's a good video, actually, not to talk about Dota 2 instead, but like, a guy called Purge, who's actually in this alpha, I think I got matchmade with him, who's a very prominent Dota 2 YouTuber, made some brilliant guides, but now plays professionally in Korea. He occasionally will cast a public game. You know, he'll just take a replay from Dota thing and cast it, and it's this game that he did recently, the last couple of days, I think, which is, it's a professional player casting a game between people who probably never played the game before, or like two of them have. And they have an okay time, but everyone's decisions are dreadful. And it was weird watching it for me, because it made me realize how much I know. Because these players are making decisions that aren't necessarily bad, if you've played any RPG ever, but they're astonishingly awful. Why the hell would you do that? From the point of view with anyone with a couple of thousand hours experience. and he's very sort of in, he makes it really clear at the start that it's not, you know, he's a really sound guy the way he comes across his videos, Purge, but he makes clear, like, it's fun to make fun of people for being new, but everyone is new, and there's something wrong with being new. And so you can kind of enjoy this video on those terms, but, you know, most people, and there's one guy who gets ruined. Every decision he makes is wrong. He does nothing but die the entire game. He contributes nothing, basically. He's basically just a big lane creep, for the other team to feed off for the entire game. And at the end, he's just sat in the fountain. His character's like a little flappy snake thing. And he's just sat in the fountain, sadly flapping away, and Purge sort of intones, well, he's never playing Dota again. And that's completely true, right? Like, I completely respect that one guy's decision to never, ever touch this awful game ever again. And I think what Heroes of the Storm does is create a system whereby that's not necessarily such a worry, right? Someone will log on, probably have an okay time. They might not win, but they're not going to win because they bought two shoes. And what the fuck were they thinking? Like, no one buys two shoes, Graham. That's ridiculous.
You buy, the shoes that you buy are individual?
No, well, they're
two pairs of shoes.
Well, yeah, I mean, shoes are kind of a concept.
They're not literal shoes.
Because some of the characters, one of the characters is a ball of light. Still needs shoes, Graham. How many shoes? What if the character is a horse? Eh?
Yeah. This is true. Like, anyway. You just mentioned a flappy snake.
And a flappy snake that flies. Yeah, like, anyway. This is getting off the point. The point is that Heroes of the Storm takes away all those decisions. So you, and that goes back actually before the game starts, right back to like how the menus are constructed and how the game is constructed. So you load it up for the very first time and you're put into a tutorial which sets up what's happening. And it's actually really nicely done. It's, you play as Jim Raynor from StarCraft, who's one of the heroes, cause it's Blizzard, Warcraft, sorry, Blizzard characters. So Warcraft, Diablo, and StarCraft. So it's the guy from StarCraft. And he's, you know, doing StarCraft things and fighting some Zerg when he's miraculously, like, spirited away into space to this place called the Nexus. And because the Nexus is what a lot of the main Protoss building in StarCraft is called Nexus, like, a booming voice that actually belongs to a Warcraft character goes like, Jim Raynor, you're in the Nexus now. And he goes, oh, so I'm in a Protoss place. He's like, no, a different Nexus. And it's Blizzard being funny, which they're often, you know, better at than the kind of the heavy lore stuff. And introduce all these ideas, and there's some great, like, there's a great, like, running gag, because the villain for the sake of the tutorial, as it teaches you about killing creeps and leveling up and all this stuff, is Diablo. And Diablo shows up and says, I can taste your fear! And there's this running joke that, like, actually, Diablo, fear doesn't have a taste. It's an emotion. I can taste your terror! No, you can't! It's not a real thing you can taste! And that's really nice. And that's a good one. And then you prompt the game proper. And there's a little pool of free heroes and the rest of that to buy, a bit like League. And you pick your hero and click play, and then it queues for a game for you. And the really crucial difference is that you picked your hero before you started playing. And you queue for the hero you want. And that might not sound massive, but it's fucking massive. Because what it means is, I think it's possibly a necessity in a game where they're charging, at least in the alpha, a reasonable premium for heroes, something like 10 quid. If you're going to charge people, this will be a free-to-play game, if you're going to charge people that much, I suspect you have to let them queue for the hero they want to play. You can't say, you know, this hero costs you £10, but you only get to play him if your team agrees that it fits the composition you're going for. So you queue for your hero, you get placed in the game with other people playing different heroes, although people on different sides can play the same hero. And then you load into one of four maps, etc. to one of that set. What that takes away is drafting, picking heroes to counter other heroes, compositions, and pre-game strategy. So the entire part of Dota that's given over to people yelling at drafting in pro games is gone. Like, it does not exist. And that then settles the game design itself, where even though there are hero roles where, you know, some people are assassins and warriors and tanks and healers and whatever, pretty much anyone can be built to do pretty much anything, although there are some substantial differences between certain heroes, which I think I talked about last time. And then in the maps themselves, the lanes are kind of important, but because teams have XP bars rather than individuals, how many people are in the lane and what they're doing and who's actually killing the creeps doesn't really matter. As long as someone's in a lane, the entire team is getting XP for it. So it still makes sense for there to be at least one person in each one, but other people are free to roam, for example, without losing experience. And because there's no gold, like, there's no running back to the shop, there's no levels to buy. When your team levels up, the game presents you with a little list of options to pick from, new passive bonuses, basically. And then at level 10, you pick one ability that's basically your ultimate ability that gets added to your character. And so rather than ever having to even think about consulting a guide, every decision you make from the moment you click your hero and start queuing happens sort of in the present tense. You know, so much of these games, even League and other like lane pushing games, are about anticipating and planning ahead. And in order to plan ahead effectively, you use the knowledge you've gleaned from thousands of hours of experience. You think of the types of situations you've seen, because they're so insanely complicated. You get used to looking through this dense mass of information you're given and looking for a solution to the problem, which is how do I win this match, based on experience and then your knowledge of what the other team is likely to do. And you kind of, and each team is trying to climb on top of the other one in that way. Whereas in Heroes, it's much more about, oh, what are they doing right now? What do I want right now? Oh, the enemy team is really rushing in and getting close. I'm going to pick, you know, I like, there's a character called Uther, who's like a paladin. And one of his ultimates lets you make another player invincible for a certain amount of time. And his other one spins a hammer around him, which stuns people and does damage. And so in different games, it's gone, oh, they've been grouping up quite a lot. I'm just going to pick the one that spins around and does damage. And in other games, you go, okay, well, you know, this match seems to be about small groups chasing each other around the map. I'm going to pick the one that lets me make my friend invincible.
It sounds much more like an action game, basically. Mm. Like, it sounds more like it's Counter-Strike, in that there's a bit of strategy and tactics and reactive decision-making at the start of a round over if you're getting hammered in a close-up fight, you'll pick up a sniper rifle and try and pick people off from afar kind of thing on your next round. It sounds much more like that. Is that accurate?
To an extent. It still has... It was interesting, I streamed it on Friday night, and some people, Owen actually, formerly of the PC Gamer podcast, people remember, and now of Mojang, was saying that, like, it looked way more like any other lane pushing game than he expected. He expected a much more substantial move towards action game.
Mm.
You know, you still sort of use abilities in the same way and things like that. And also, it is possible for teams to snowball out of control, right? Like, it doesn't have that kind of baseline level of lethality, for example, that Counter-Strike has, right? Where no matter how much of a money advantage the other team has, a bullet's still a bullet. It is possible in the Dota-style way for a team to get to the point where, okay, they pulled three levels ahead because of some big fights they won. We probably can't pull this back. Mm. That's compensated for by the matches being a lot shorter. And so for those reasons, I like it. The real thing I do like about it, that all of this various things I've said all come towards, is it remains possible to win long past the point where in a Dota match you'd probably have thought, this is gone. If I explained this last time, but I explained it again, each map has a different, like, it's not a gimmick, but like a different map thing and map objective that changes the way you play on that particular map. So one of them has a pirate and a pirate ship, and there are NPCs in the jungle, quote unquote, that you can go off and kill, and they drop gold, and you can pay the pirate, and there's chests that appear, and you can smack them and gather gold, and if you're killed, you drop your gold, but if a team manages to pay the pirate enough gold, he bombards the enemy's structures. So that's, all of these things are based around the idea of pushing faster, so, you know, the pirate will bombard for you. There's another one where, one player, if a team controls two shrines, one player can become this sort of like hyper powerful different hero for a limited amount of time, who's crazily more powerful than anyone else, and that again is a big incentive to just go and push, go and do something. And the one I've been playing a lot of, it's called the Haunted Mines, and there are two maps. There's the overground, which are the lanes and the bases and everything it are, and then every so often the mines open, and underneath the map there's this sort of like labyrinth of mine caverns full of undead. You go down there and you start killing the undead and picking up their skulls. And each team has a visible skull tally. And there are 100 skulls total in the mines. And that is basically a percentage value, because when all the undead are killed, including like a boss undead, when 100% of the skulls have been collected, a big golem spawns in each base, and your golem's power is proportional to the total number of skulls out of 100 your team collected. So if you have 60% of the skulls, and the other team has 40, you have a 60% golem, they have a 40% golem. And those golems then move down different lanes, so you've got to imagine them, like, moving clockwise, you know, the top one moving to the left and the bottom one moving to the right. And you can rush to kill the enemy golem first, and then rush to defend your own, help it push, or whatever. And when a golem is killed, its spawn point next time it's summoned will be where it died. So if you let a golem get too far, you know, so for example, you might, and this leads to actually loads of really interesting, like, in and of itself, strategic, like, variants on that formula. So, for example, there might be a team that doesn't really bother much with the mines the first time they open, but escorts their golem really, 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 really far. And then the next time they really try, because they know if they can summon a really powerful golem inside the enemy base by this point, then it'll do that much more. And that's sort of like, but the reason I brought that up is because last night I played a game where a guy came onto this team chat at the beginning and went, "Hey guys, let's just ignore the mines completely. I don't think they're very good. Like, if we focus on getting minions from the forest, which you can do, if we focus on pushing, when they're in the mines, we'll have an advantage that they won't come back from even with their mega beefy golem." And it almost didn't work because, their first golem, they ended up with 100 golem to our 0 golem. And the ours went down really quickly, and we struggled to stop theirs. We ended up taking the same amount of buildings that they took, but in the time we spent trying to take down their fucking golem, after we'd done the kind of equivalent pushing, they'd gone and done a bunch of other objectives as well, and kind of, so they won the benefit. And it came down to both bases being exposed, and us having an experience deficit. So we just 5-manned up, bunched up, and then, like, the moment we could, pushed out of our base and went straight for their throne, won a really crucial team fight and won the match from behind. And that's very difficult to do in Dota 2. When that happens in Dota 2, either the pro scene or otherwise, it's fucking amazing. Like, I think in my entire career of Dota, I've come back from having nothing left around your ancient, like, less than 5 times. Like, it's, you know, it's massively rare, and it's happened about that many times, even in the 3 days I've been playing Heroes of the Storm. So that's something really to its credit, I think. That's really exciting that you can have a game that does turn that late. I mean, many games don't have that. Counter-Strike doesn't have that, really. It's very difficult to come back from a money deficit. The things I'd like to raise is, I think, potential problems, and the reasons, I mean, and with the caveat that it's in alpha, it doesn't feel particularly great, which is unusual for Blizzard.
That was going to be my main question. Like, how does it feel? If it's less of the kind of macro strategy, surely it depends more on feeling really nice when you kill them.
Like, this is the game, this is the company that made Hearthstone, a game that made fucking placing cards on a board feel fucking amazing. It's also the company that made Diablo 3, which is now an excellent game, but even when it wasn't an excellent game, it's still an amazing feeling game.
Mm.
Like, that is a good game to punch a skeleton in. Those fuckers crunch. Right, it's good. But Heroes of the Storm really doesn't have that. And I think in part that's a little bit because of its forgiving design. People have quite a lot of health. It's quite hard to kill someone. Like, there are stuns and things in the game, but they don't last very long. So a lot of fights will descend, and the bases are never that far apart. So a lot of fights, especially early, will descend into one person just running back to the base as a little train of enemies chase after them, doing their tiny little spells to try and nip away at them. And spells aren't very damaging. For example, really, it takes a coordinated attempt from a group of people, really, to kill someone. One-on-one fights are that kind of hard for either person to win a lot of the time, unless they start with an advantage. And likewise, I think there's... I'm struggling to pin it down exactly, but there's something about either the way the mouse movement feels or the way characters turn. Like, there's a thing in Dota called turn rate, which is if your character's facing one direction, you click behind them, how long it takes them to turn around to walk in that direction. And a lot of balancing is based on those kinds of variables. And every hero in Heroes feels like it kind of lumbers around, like steering a little... Actually, like steering a little gang beasts dude around sometimes, where they just refuse to kind of face the direction you want. And so for those reasons, I don't think it feels as good as it could. And that's probably problem A. Problem B is something that I've experienced in the alpha, and I suspect will happen again when the game, every time the game expands, which is its audience at the moment is made up of primarily people who are very familiar with League of Legends, where you can surrender, or very familiar with Dota, where you can't surrender, but people still like to try. And at the moment, Heroes has no penalty for leaving matches at all. You can just leave a match if you don't want to, and your character's replaced by an AI. And even though all of these things I've said about how it's possible to turn a game around in the latter stages, even though that's possible in this game, because it's not possible in the other games, or not as likely in the other games that it looks like, it has a cultural problem where people don't believe that's the case yet. And so I've had loads of problems with people abandoning matches. And this is even in an alpha pool of players, which I've never seen exceed 800 people online at any given time. And it has this problem with people going, fuck this, I'm out. Like, we lost an early team fight. If this was League, I'd have, GG'd and quit. So I'm just going to quit. And that often means that even though technically it is on paper possible to win games, even if you have a bad start, at the moment, culturally, it's actually quite difficult to keep some people in the game. And I think that's obviously, this sample is not representative, and hopefully there will be people who come to the game without that prior experience for whom that will not be the case. But Dota's pretty popular. League of Legends is pretty popular. The game has to do a better job either of preventing people from abandoning quite the same way, or of educating people, this isn't that game you know. See this match out and you'll be surprised, rather than like, because there's no penalty, people at the moment are like, oh fuck this, I'm off to re-queue for one when we start well. Just roll the dice until I get a good, a good circumstance. The final thing that I'm concerned about, but not to the extent that I know enough about how the game's balanced yet, and obviously, balance issues as a whole, I'm not really interested in the alpha, because it's an alpha and there will be overpowered abilities and things. Although it's interesting how that interacts with the drafting thing. Being overpowered from a game design point of view is actually okay in Dota. It's a game feature, really. Like, the idea that some heroes will be more powerful than others is balanced by the notion that in competitive play, people can ban heroes. So, there's a bargaining metagame that has to have imbalance built into the system for it to be interesting. Like, you have to have different levels of value in order to have that bargaining at the beginning of the game to be meaningful. But, like, as I said, how much damage something does, that's not interesting balance consideration. But the game does currently have two, I think, permanently invisible heroes. And if anyone's trying to learn to play Dota 2, the thing everyone comes up against early is, what the fuck do you do about Ricky? Because Ricky's a hero whose ultimate makes him permanently invisible until he attacks. And when you're a new player and you don't know about buying anti-invisibility items like sentry wards and dust and stuff like that, you're like, how the fuck do I counter this? This guy is just invisible all the fucking time. This is impossible. Heroes has characters like that, but it doesn't have the counters. The counters are attached to certain characters and not all. And every game I've had that has felt like a fuck this, I'm off stomp has been a result of having two permanently invisible characters in the game. Like, either one or the other one showing up there. Tassadar, Zeratul, the Protoss guy, who's like an invisible assassin, and Nova, the ghost from the ghost assassin lady who never got her own game. Both of them feel total bullshit. And I kind of appreciate that if you'd asked me 3 days into my Dota experience, what was total bullshit in Dota, I would have said Ricky, and then subsequently learned the way in which it's countered. But I know these games now, and I've drilled through, and I'm like, I know there are heroes, and some heroes have optional abilities that do reveal invisibility or whatever. but they're not consistently available enough.
Well, you're not going to get them if you're picking it.
Exactly.
Of the
if there's no drafting phase. Yeah. Like, you know, when people know now, if they insta-pick Ricky, you pick up a Slardar or a Bounty Hunter, obviously. Because they both they're two heroes that have abilities that reveal invisibility. So, that's something that really concerns me. Like, I don't want them to make bland heroes just because there's no drafting phase. And I think maybe that's a little bit part of the feedback problem is no hero can be like, you know, fucking exciting because then not everyone just wants to keep that one.
Yeah. Can they not kind of defer the anti-invisibility powers to some item or pickup or something?
Items is what solves this in Dota. Because, you know, everyone has there's no inventory and no items in Heroes. Mm. So that's the thing. In Dota, yeah, you can say, okay, it doesn't matter how bad your draft is. You might not have counted this guy on the draft, but you can just go and buy wards or whatever. There's no such thing as that. Like, it feels like there needs to be some consistent game way of mitigating that particular advantage because, like, I mean, just from a design point of view, it puts you in a position where you feel like you can't win. And what's important is not only the impact in terms of actual, like, numbers, like, okay, this guy has gotten a few easy kills because he's invisible, so therefore they have an experience advantage. It's the impact it has on team psychology. It's actually very hard to strategize as a group when you're having to respond to a new, very specific problem. Like, it happens in Dota all the time, where someone drafts a hero that the other team wasn't expecting to have to deal with, and then the kind of the plan, what they wanted to happen, then play second fiddle to countering that. And in that game, it's possible. And I've had, you know, teams, well-organized teams, run around in circles not really knowing what to do about the invisible guy. And admittedly, it's early days, but it is a concern for me. I don't know if it's actually a function that should be exist in that game at the moment, because...
How would you fix that? Just remove the ability or give
them change the it? I think so. There's a thing in the game called, it works like League of Legends, and I forgot what it's called because I don't play LOL, but it's like undergrowth, like brush or something. And it's like tall grass, basically. And when you're in the tall grass, you're invisible. It's the equivalent of line of sight in Dota, where if you're on the other side of a tree, you're basically invisible.
Right.
But it is like literally a zone, like a little area of terrain where if you walk into it, you can only you can see outside it, people can't see in. Unless they're also in the grass. Then you can see people who are in the grass. And so you can use this to, like, break line of sight or to run in and out to lose people in a chase or whatever. And if, for example, they had a thing whereby an invisible hero can run into the grass, turn invisible, and then carry that invisibility with them longer than other heroes get it when they leave the grass, that might be a way of fixing it. So it becomes, like, functionally, you know, those people can carry invisibility with them a little bit longer than other people. It takes longer for them to reappear after being invisible. After being out of someone's line of sight, maybe it takes them longer to appear on the way in. That would be maybe an interesting compromise. So they wouldn't be, you know, if you were in lane with them, they wouldn't be permanently invisible because you get to see them all the time. But if you lose track of them, then they can get close to you without being seen. That, I think, would be how I'd fix it because it would solve the biggest problem. The biggest problem with having these guys in the game, as I said earlier, kills are very rarely one-on-one. But if you see a hero guy on his own, you might be tempted to engage. At the moment, you have no idea of knowing if it's two. And so I found myself, you know, playing maybe a roaming character, trying to pick off kills. And then I'd go and run on someone who looked vulnerable and alone. And then find out that, oh, there's two invisible people with him. And there was no way reasonably for me to have found that out in advance. Mm. So, fuck it. And then, going back to the psychological impact, then you never do that again. Like, you then don't seize upon actual opportunities to kill people, because the suspicion, like, an invisible hero could literally be anywhere. So those are my collected, maybe possibly too deep at this stage, thoughts about Heroes of the Storm.
I'm quite interested in Dota 2 as a piece of design, and quite interested in, like, the reason I don't play it isn't that I don't necessarily like it, it's that I don't think I can commit the thousands of hours required in order to enjoy it, and the reason for that is the reason I want to play Dota is that all my friends have played it for thousands of hours and I want to hang out with my friends, or B, because what's interesting about Dota is that kind of really complex strategy to it. So a game which strips back that and turns it into Duplo Dota doesn't necessarily retain the things that make me want to play Dota. So, like theoretically, Blizzard All-Stars should be the Dota game for me, someone who doesn't have the time for Dota, but I'm not sure it's actually what I want. So I'm kind of curious, like, do you think I'm wrong about that, or is it the kind of thing where you can imagine yourself playing it?
I've gone back and forth on this as I've been frustrated with it and pleased with it. I really like the map objectives. I really like the map strategy element. And I think that'll be a really useful training tool for something that actually takes people a very long time in, though. So people learn heroes, they learn abilities, they learn how to gank people and this stuff. They don't really learn about timing and rotations for a very long time. A rotation is when you move heroes from one lane to another lane or around the map. So when you start to leave your initial starting positions and perform objectives. In Dota, those objectives are self-set. You say, I'm going to try and gank this hero. Heroes of the Storm does a good job of really, literally drawing a ring around the types of things you might want to do. You might want to go here and kill these golems, these giants, because then these giants will come and fight for your side. You might want to go here because this hero is doing this. And it's really good at signposting the things that you just learn to see in Dota. And that's useful because it's those kinds of plays are, you know, one of the rewards for getting to your 600, 700 hour mark in Dota when you and your friends all leave at once and go invisible and sneak up on someone and kill them. And it's better at producing that experience early. However, like, the easiest comparison to make is that Heroes of the Storm is to Dota what Hearthstone is to Magic the Gathering. But I'm starting to think that might be a little bit of a misleading comparison, because I think it might be the case, actually, that Dota is so complicated that it doesn't reduce as cleanly as Magic did in Hearthstone's case, where they could just say, okay, there are fewer resource types, we're going to take away a lot of the other interactions and focus on a few of them. And that is, it's still kind of the same design process, I think, in some ways. Like, it's equivalent. But something is lost. And if that thing is important to you, and the thing that really is lost is accident. Like, chance. Like, I can't imagine at the moment people really watching lengthy weekly compilation videos of the craziest things to happen in Heroes of the Storm that week. I think they'll watch videos of it. But, you know, those are so complicated that there are potential interactions between abilities, items, other abilities, etc., heroes, stats, except that lead to these moments where, like, what the fuck just happened? And then you pick it apart, and it's, like, kind of just sort of amazing trying to figure out what in the vast sort of complicated whirring box of parts made that thing happen. Like, today in Dota, I'm playing a hero called Earthshaker, whose ultimate is called Echo Slam, where he smacks the ground, and every hero in a little radius around him then echoes, every unit in a little radius around him echoes with damage. And every time those echoes hit another one, they bounce again. So it does more damage to everyone the more units it hits at once. And I was playing against a hero called Undying, who can plant a tombstone, and then the tombstone constantly spawns zombies in an area around, and those zombies intensify around heroes with low health. And so that's usually a big problem. And then another character, playing Invoker, who's like a wizard, as you might expect, was trying to kill me, and the tombstone was there, and I was sort of like smacking away at it, trying to destroy it, actually, because it was ruining things for my friends. Hit me with an item called the Yule Scepter, which caused me to go spinning up into the air as an invulnerable in a cyclone for like a couple of seconds. So I'm invulnerable, just spinning around pointlessly above the battle as this team fight happens below me, and these zombies multiply. And then, during the time I was in the air, I mean, I would have died if he hadn't done that. If he hadn't made the decision to remove me from the fight temporarily, I probably would have been killed in the melee. As I came back down to Earth, my ult came off cooldown. I had Echo Slam. And I basically, like, and so Earthshaker looks like a kind of gorilla bear giant thing with, carries a massive totem. And as I tumble back down to Earth from the spiraling whirlwind, I smack Echo Slam, and he bellows, Echo Slam! And everyone dies. Like, just because it hits the zombies, it hits tombstones, it hits both teams, just, not my team, but you know what I mean? Like, it, you know, and just melts, and like, triple kill or something, and someone on my team goes, nice! And it's like, yeah! And it's a very particular interaction between loads of things. And also, it was really funny, because I was spinning around in the air when I came down to do it, so I typed, like, hashtag 360 no scope into the chat, like, get wrecked, whatever. You know what I mean? Get a bit aggro. It's good. Anyway. That interaction comes from loads of different things playing together in a way that Heroes doesn't seem to support, because everything has had its edges sanded off so that you can't. Because having that chance for great success is also a chance to fuck up dramatically.
Yeah, it feels like for this to fit into your life, it has to be like, give you a Dota-ish thrill, but perhaps without some of the stress that comes with the complexity of that.
And I have been stressed to people. I've been stressed at leavers, particularly people who give up. I'd like to play it with you guys, basically. You're kind of the ideal people who probably have the capacity to be good at Dota, but not the time. And therefore, you can do the strategic stuff, like the moving character around a map. I'd like to play with you guys and see what you thought in a team situation. Because if it was possible, if there was a game that my non-Dota playing friends wanted to play that involved some of the same ideas and had some of the same qualities, if not the real highs, then I think I would play it, actually.
Mm.
Because it's not a great commitment of my time. Like, I don't really feel pressured to learn it, which is the great thing that held me back from ever playing League of Legends, because put so much time into this other game, I'm not going to go spend the same amount of time learning a different one. But this one, because it doesn't really feel like it requires the same amount of just book learning, I feel like I can go and play it, run around, and probably have a nice time, hopefully.
Could the three of us play it together and that be a fan experience? You coming with your 2,000 hours of Dota experience and us coming with...
I think we could. I think it's a good equalizer, actually. It's a good leveler. And that'll probably be where its value for people comes from. That said, all the other things I mentioned, like, I think the feel of it just isn't good enough at the moment, and that will make things feel... It doesn't need to not be nice to land a skill shot on somebody.
Mm.
That's something they should just fix. And I'm worried about the presence of heroes that would upset that competitive balance, because I'd like to be able to log in with you guys and go, hey guys, we're gonna really go for the mines this time, and that's gonna be our strategy, and then, oh, they've got invisible people, and now we're panicking and everyone's angry. It's just like Dota now, and then you guys quit forever. Like, that's I hope they either need to commit more to it being Duplo and shave off even more of those edges, or maybe invest a little bit more in finding things you can learn to counter these strategies.
Speaking of investing a little bit more...
Great segue, Graham.
Marsh, you've been investing a little bit more time in a game you spoke about once before.
I've been playing Goddess, which is actually quite... It's not an interesting comparison point, because there's not very much interesting about Goddess at all, but it is in alpha, Heroes of the Storm, but it couldn't be more different. I mean, it was interesting hearing you talk about kind of reducing a really complex game of extremely dynamic variables that collide in lots of interesting ways and trying to exert your agency over that, to a game which has almost none of those things. Like, you remember when... I think it was Sid Meier who said a game is a series of interesting decisions.
Yeah.
And Goddess, as when it was first released in alpha last year, really had none. Like, it was impressive how they'd managed to remove any kind of decision-making process from the game whatsoever. I didn't like it very much, as you can probably gather. But it went down really badly with everybody who reviewed it. I felt a bit bad because I didn't come to it with... I'm quite dubious about Peter Molyneux as an industry figurehead and as a designer as well, to some extent. I don't have so much animosity towards him that I was really wanted to stick the boot in. But it really is just a poor piece of design. Like, it seems that there's no evidence in that game that the people making it understood why people like interaction. Because there's no meaningful feedback from any of the things you do. You're basically... It's a god game, I should say. But your role as god is merely to facilitate the gradual expansion of something that you don't have any agency over shaping. You click on things. You click an awful lot in the game when it was originally released. You flatten this landscape, basically just completely defeature it, and this group of people just spread across it. And you don't really get any say over what that means. Well, you can't shape their civilization in any way. You don't even... If another player was to play the same game, it would fall out exactly the same way, because you just click where you have to, and then the people go where they have to, and then it just expands in that way. So you're kind of clicking to no purpose, really. So, after that astonishing release back in last year, they disappeared for a long time, went radio silent, and now they've come out with a update to the game, which addresses some of the issues. I think it is vastly improved over the original effort. That's not to say it's really a good game, because in its original form, it was kind of execrable. But they've certainly addressed the clicking issue, because now you don't have to repeatedly click on anything. Sculpting a land is much nicer. Before it was kind of this weird thing. It was like touching a really sticky thing, and it would twang back off you in really annoying ways as you're trying to stretch the land. And it was really miserly with the amount that you were allowed to do that. So you constantly had to expend belief to kind of manipulate the environment, and you had to collect belief by clicking on every single one of the houses in your entire settlement, which I think would number well over 50. I can't remember. A lot of clicking involved, and you have to do it constantly. But now they've got this thing, this kind of leash paradigm that they call, and you click once on anything you want to interact with, and you can just drag your mouse pointer around by holding down the mouse. And it draws this kind of squiggly line. But wherever that line passes, it then enacts the same thing. So if you want to kind of crush rocks, you click once on a rock, and then you can move your mouse in a sweeping motion over other rocks, and it'll crush them. And, you know, if you want to collect belief, you click on one house, and then you can sweep it over all the other houses to collect belief. So that's, and it's actually really a very pleasing kind of tactile interaction, and the game sounds lovely in general, and looks nice, and there's kind of, it's a pleasing form of physical feedback from your actions. But the one thing that they haven't fixed by implementing that is your need to do it in the first place. because there is really, like, I'm a god. People believe in me. Why do I need to collect belief? In order to...
Do you keep it in your belief bag?
Well, I wouldn't mind it if I had a belief bag and it just filled up automatically. But I can, it's just, it's quite a nice interaction, but it doesn't need to be there.
Mm.
Like, and nearly all of the things that interject in your experience of Goddess just don't need to be there. They just feel extraneous. Like, what gameplay reason is that it's serving, other than to delay you, that you have to go and pick this stuff up individually? There's no kind of benefit externally from doing that. It seems arbitrary. And a lot of the game just feels like it's trying to stop you from doing things efficiently. So you constantly run out of belief. There's a kind of resource flow problem with the game where it was much worse than the original version, but you obviously want to expand your civilization. You need to just kind of sandblast this environment depressingly in order to do that. But just removing a hill in order to get your people from one side of it to the other takes up so much belief that you end up just sitting there waiting for your belief to refill before you do it again.
Seems like a kind of thing that would generate belief.
Yeah, I know, it's sort of vastly counterintuitive. Like, my god, that hill just vanished, and I don't believe in God anymore.
Well, the weird thing is, crushing trees and rocks gives you belief, but crushing an entire mountain takes belief. It doesn't make a great deal of sense. But they have done some things to inject a tiny bit of extra agency. So before, you couldn't even tell people where to go. You would just flatten a piece of land, and it would automatically say, okay, a house can be built here, and then people would come out and build a house. But now, you can leash people and tell them to go somewhere. But the problem is, you can only ever tell them to go somewhere where they can go. And the places that they can go are basically limited. To the extent that you don't really have any meaningful choice. You might, in circumstances, be able to prioritize one building that they're going to build over another, but there's no real reason to do that. I mean, they're going to get to them eventually anyway, so why bother? There's like a bit of explanatory text at the beginning of the Alpha update, which from Peter Molyneux himself, and he describes the game as a zen experience. I think it might just be vapid and slow. Like, it has got a lot better, but it is still just empty, you know?
Like, he's trying to create a kind of zen garden type of thing, where, like, you know, like a little box of sand on your desk that you sweep up.
Yeah, I guess so. But I think the thing is, there are things that, I don't think an absence of agency is an innate quality of zenness. Like, there are things that are zen, or there are things that you can do which are relaxing and uplifting, which I believe is the intended effect of this game, which do not upset your agency, which do not put meaningless impediments in the way of your intent. And my intent is way ahead of this game all the time. Like, and I don't find it zen because I'm constantly frustrated by it. I'm constantly bored and frustrated that I can't do the things that I want to do in the game.
It is exactly about agency. It's not necessarily about having your choices, like, have some kind of, like, vast impact in the long term, but having them mean something in the short term, I suspect. Because, like, playing Civ is quite relaxing, as long as you're not playing it on, kind of, like, a brutally crushing difficulty level.
Mm.
Like, playing Civ on easy, you'll probably win, as long as you do something, pretty much. As long as you keep adhering to the basic principles of expanding and gaining resources and power in whatever way you've chosen to do so, you'll probably eventually win. So by continuing to play, what you're doing is watching that, you know, algorithm resolve itself into you're the best.
Mm.
But you still make decisions. Like, you're still constantly deciding, oh, you know, I'm going to do a run where the Byzantines invent space travel and get to Alpha Centauri before everyone else. And that's going to be my campaign. And you might be doing it in a relatively challenge-free way, but you're still choosing. And the act of choosing is something that's quite important to people. If you're not choosing, then you're not actually really
interacting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. There's no point. You're just basically clicking for a screensaver to continue, I feel, a lot of the time in Goddess.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating that it doesn't make more of the aspect of it, of Godhead. Like, I mean, you don't get to shape your civilization in any kind of way. And I'm not saying I should be able to issue particular Ten Commandments or anything like that, but you'd expect to have some kind of way of ordering them around. Well, in fact, the thing that really sticks in my craw is that the game is about just destroying the world. You just flatten the entire environment. You take out these lovely trees and hills, and you just bulldozer it just so you can splurge yurts over it. And I don't know, but I feel like if I was a god, even a god who's sustained by the belief of a particular people, I would want them to live in some kind of harmonious way with their environment. I would want to make the world look beautiful. And all of those instincts are completely swept aside by Goddess. It's just, you just smash everything to the floor.
Wasn't there going to be all this interesting stuff with, like, the guy who won Curiosity, what's in the cube, by clicking the last block, that he was going to be setting these kind of ten
he was the god in Goddess.
Yeah, I don't know what's happened to that, actually. Yeah, that hasn't been mentioned, I don't think. Recently. Mm. It might be that I'm only because the saves were reset with the patch necessarily so I'm only about 4-5 hours into it, so it might be that there are decisions at some
but you're
point.
Four to 5 hours into it at this point, and yet I've not encountered them.
Yeah. There's another kind of game mode now, though, which is quite early in the game, you unlock a boat, and it says, go on a voyage! You're on a voyage, and it's a completely different mode, which is more like Lemmings. So your boat docks at an island, there's a temple on the other side, you choose how many people disembark, and you need to get a certain number of them over to the other side of the island, alive and in time.
For what?
In time for tea, just before the counter clocks down.
Okay.
And so you need to rapidly reshape the island with whatever belief you have, or in some cases just kind of plant totems so that your people can walk quickly across a swamp and things like this.
Wasn't
it's kind of like buffs and stuff.
Wasn't there a game specifically about that? What was it called?
Oh, From Dust.
From Dust.
Yeah. It's basically From Dust, but not as interesting in other ways. It's
From Dust didn't have just a counter that was ticking down. It had like these kind of awesome floods and fluid physics and stuff like that. And,
yeah, lava,
bubbling volcanoes. Yeah,
yeah, and you could endlessly reshape the landscape in that, I believe. Yeah. Whereas it's more interesting. Like, I mean, it's the physical structure of Goddess, but repurposed to be an actual game. So that's I think a good start. But it's there's no real challenge to it apart from the foibles of the AI, who won't always work out the route that you've just carved for them is navigable.
Did you play Populous back in the day?
I didn't actually. No, so I don't know. I mean, maybe it's very loyal.
Quite similar. Populous. Like, populist was impressive in the at the time for a bunch of technological reasons in terms of being able to manipulate the terrain and having these little people that walked around. But, you know, it wasn't that interactive, really, by today's standards. And actually, that's like, Black and White gets a lot of stick for a lot of different reasons, and quite rightfully so. Like, if you play that game single player, its missions, objectives, the things you were asked to do as the god of this land were complete bullshit. But taking a kind of populist concept and then making it a bit more of a city builder and then giving you your little animal sidekick and making it about training them and good and evil and...
all the creature stuff was great.
Yeah, and how you... imposed your will, whether you wanted to be an evil god or a good god and that kind of thing. Like, that was a way of taking the base populist design and modernizing it in a way that was really interesting, even if it wasn't wholly successful. And Goddess seems like it just doesn't have any ideas, basically. Like, it doesn't seem to have a thing of, like, this is why this will be interesting.
I don't see it there yet. It is only, I think when it was first released, they said it was 40% of the way done, and now I think it's 48% or maybe 50%, I can't remember. But, they've got plenty of percent to go.
Yeah,
I sound pretty scathing about it, but, I can now see that this could eventually evolve into something enjoyable.
Okay.
Whereas when I first played it, there was really no sign of that ever occurring.
Yeah, it seems like what they've worked on hasn't been the 8% between 40 and 48. It's been redoing that first 40%, and they pretty much pitched it as Goddess 2.0, I think they call it.
Yeah, yeah. But they need to inject purpose and meaning and choice into that game. None of which is there currently.
Well, they need to inject game into that screensaver.
Yeah, yeah. How much? It's a very nice screensaver, really. I mean, you know, it's pretty.
How much does it cost?
I've forgotten now, because I bought it ages ago.
Is it, like, 15 quid, or is it 30?
I really don't know. Ugh. I think it's... No, I wouldn't like to hazard a guess, I'm afraid.
Either way, why would anyone buy into it? Because it's been out for quite a while, and there are a lot of alpha games which you can buy and have some modicum of basic fun right from the off.
Yeah, the vertical slice thing. There's no vertical. This is very horizontal. And as flat as the land that you obliterate.
It's like the bottom slice of like a vanilla, of a sponge cake or something, where there's no jam or cream.
It's all been licked off by the dog.
Peter Molyneux invented a dog.
He did, yeah.
He did. Did he fall in love with it?
And he's ruined that cake.
What have you been playing, Graham?
I've been playing two games, and I'll start. I'm showing off. I'm going to start with the one which is kind of zen, because it seems fitting. I've been playing OMSI 2, Omnibus Simulator 2. OMSI was a 1980s set bus simulator that took place in West Berlin, where you could drive a particular type of 1980s bus. And it was created by two guys who used to ride this bus to school every morning across Berlin. And it was a kind of sleeper hit. Like, it had crossover appeal, and not quite to the same degree as something like Euro Truck Simulator does. It's much more complicated. It doesn't have the kind of management or macro layer stuff to it. But just the feeling of kind of trundling around in your bus and having this real sense of place and atmosphere to it. Like, it's partly things like the sound effects, the way your bus creaks and shakes and rocks as you turn around corners, physics models brewing. But it's also just, if you've ever just got, say, into the back of a cab in Grand Theft Auto 4, and driven that cab journey across the other side of the city just for the fun of looking out the window, it has that sort of feeling to it. It's just a tremendous sense of place. And a few weeks ago, I finally got round to buying a Logitech Driving Force GT, which is a steering wheel peripheral for your PC. It's the one that everyone recommends, basically, if you're getting into your first steering wheel, because it's got things like, it's got a gear stick, it's got pedals, not three, so there's no clutch, but it's got two pedals as a separate base, and it's got proper 2.5 turns of the wheel, So I bought that. It's about 100 quid. You can pick it up from Amazon. And I've just been sat at home driving my route in OMSI 2, which came out just at the end of last year. And when it first came out, it was really broken. It had a bunch of bugs in it and stuff like that, like pedestrians would clip through walls and that sort of stuff. Most of that seems to have been fixed now, or at least I haven't encountered that much of it. Although it does have, your bus will have bugs, like deliberate bugs, like it has kind of, I think I've talked on the podcast before about X-Plane, about how you can set that up to simulate certain
bird strike,
and that causes tremendous drama because you've just been hit by a bunch of birds, your windscreen's got a crack in it, your engine's broken. Where is the closest airfield that you can safely land before you just plow into the side of a mountain? In OMSI 2, my rear door had a problem where it wouldn't shut correctly, so it would just keep, it would get stuck halfway and then open again. And then
slightly less fatal.
Yeah. But it's absolutely crazy in the level of detail that's in there, because it's stuff like, in order to fix that problem with your back door, I have to keep turning off the electrics, and that's like a button on my dashboard, and it's mapped to the keyboard, or I can use my mouse to, like, poke it with a finger, basically. But it simulates completely perfectly the dash of these buses from 1980s West Germany. And so you can, like, the ticket-making machine where you type in your route number and then you type in what stops you're going to make, and then when people come on board and they ask you for a particular type of ticket and you click to tear off the correct type of ticket or type in the fare and press a button in order to print it out. If you want to change the sign on the front of your bus, which says where you're going, there are three different ways to do it. You can either do it the cheeky way, which is just to use like a keyboard shortcut to do it really quickly. You've got a set of buttons just above your windscreen where you can, press down or press up. And a light comes on to show you that it's rotating. And so it's like there is literally just a clipboard on the window to your left listing all the stops. And it says like, oh, I'm headed towards number 14. Well, then you've got to press that button 14 times and wait for it to go boop on the front of your bus. Or you can use like a hand crank, basically, where you can use F5 and F7 in order to manually wind through to change the sign. So there's three different ways through which you can change the sign in the front of your bus. And that's not including the sign which you put on your dashboard. Like if you're making a stop which isn't part of the reel, so if you're a school bus, then maybe you put a sign on the side, and nor does it include the sign which you can put on the side of your bus by the back door so that passengers can see that. So look, it creates this experience basically where you get in your cab, you sit down, and if you've ever been near a bus when a new driver has just got in and they're there for like 10 minutes where you're standing outside in the cold wishing they'd let you on board and you wonder why they won't open the fucking doors and let you on. Well, this is what they're doing, basically. They're, like, filling in a little sheet, and they're pressing buttons, and they're winding things to make the sign on the front correctly, and they're turning on the electrics, and all this stuff. And then you go on a little drive around this. It's quite basically modeled, so, like, the textures aren't great. It's not that many polygons on screen, but there's a tremendous sense of place, because it's all based on the genuine real locations of 1980s Berlin, exactly as those buildings were. And then you can actually play it through different periods of history as well. So, like, it's not just late 80s Berlin and then 89. You can also play it in, like, 91, 92, so there's, like, a point where you're just stuck in West Berlin because the Berlin Wall was still up, and then there's a point where there's a checkpoint now that allows you to go over to East Germany, and then there's a point where you can play the city where it's the wall's gone, and so you're freely able to drive around the city. It's got weather modelling as well, so you can play it in different seasons, and you know, all your windscreen wipers are perfectly modelled. And you just go on a little drive, and you make your stops, and you try your best not to clip the curb when you pull in. Try not to brake too suddenly when you come up to a stop, because then all the people on the bus behind you get all grumbly, because they get jolted forward. And then when you get back to your kind of to the station after you've done your run, It's maybe like 12 minutes until you've got your next run. At which point, I pick up a comic that sat on my desk and I read a comic for a bit.
Really?
Yeah. And I just sit and wait for the timer to go down, looking out the window at the, you know, the passengers piling up at the stop as I'm parked at the other side of the station. And then I drive over, pick them up, go on my way and do another run.
That's mad.
And this is a man who doesn't have time to learn Dota.
Well, like I should say, like the tutorials in OMSI 2 suck. I mean, they're badly translated from German, so it's not too badly, but pretty bad. They're all just text, and a lot of text. So, and there's like four stages, and each four of the four stages is broken up into like 30 different 300-word chunks of text teaching you every element of the game's menus and the game's dashboards and stuff like that. And you don't really need to know all of it, but I spent probably an hour poring over those tutorials to teach myself how to do the basics, and then, you know, kind of I'm learning on the job now.
What's it like going through a checkpoint from west to east?
I've never actually done that. I've never gone through the checkpoint. I mostly still just play, because there's...
Can you defect?
That would be
very different game.
It's like, it's like a Papers, Please thing in there. That would be cool. But there's two cities. So there's Berlin, which is the main one, and it's pretty huge, actually. There's a bunch of different districts. Or there's like a small village, which is kind of set up as the tutorial town. And I mostly play that, because it's quite scenic and quite pretty, and it's a much slower pace. And when I'm playing it, in part because it's relaxing, in that weird way that it turns out that people's terrible jobs are relaxing. Have you guys played Euro Truck Simulator or any of these types of
games? I recently watched Andy Kelly in The Office play Euro Truck Simulator
with the Rift,
which is a phenomenal... Like, that was an amazing experience, because he's played a lot of Euro Truck Simulator. This is Euro Truck Simulator 2, I should stress. He's played a lot of it. And it is, for the same reason, as you say, in the GTA cab, is that feeling of being in a real place is somehow more relaxing than it would ever be to be in those real places in real life. But he put the Rift on, was driving his truck, and the Rift is really well supported in Euro Truck Simulator 2, so you can lean out of the windows and look out, and I was tempted to try and go and get a desk fan or something to blow at him when he was looking out the window, just trying to like freak him out. But it's also, even as an observer watching it in that kind of weird split view you have on the monitor when someone's using a Rift, where you kind of see everything twice because it's, you know, the left eye and the right eye. He was sort of showing me it, and I sit behind him, so he was kind of looking at me and therefore looking away from the road while he was driving. And the sense of fidelity was such, even as someone watching someone else wearing the virtual reality helmet, that I became instantly slightly sick at how badly he was driving. And he was in France, and he was on the wrong side of the road. And like, and then literally he's driving on this sort of long country bend, and his head is fully turned towards me, so he's functionally like looking at the chair behind him in the game, because he's sort of looking at me. And I just sort of point back, and I'm like, Andy, look! And there's another bus coming around the corner, and he's on the wrong side of the road, and he's like, you're gonna jackknife a bus, like, Jesus Christ, look! And then I realized it was a video game, and that wasn't even me in the virtual reality. How do you find it as someone who doesn't drive? I mean, does that affect it? Because, I mean, neither of us drive, so.
I imagine it would be much easier if I did drive. Stuff like using, like, I used to have a wheel, but a pretty crappy one, and it didn't have a proper gear stick. It had, like paddles on the back of a wheel, more like a racing car would have. Whereas this has got a gear stick, and so if I want to go up and down the gears, I've got to use the stick. And it's not proper H positions, it's just forward and back, basically. But just that little bit of extra physical distance is a strange thing. Like, it's not near where your fingers are. You've got to move your arm over in order to do it. And it's stuff like that, which you would be used to if you were driving a car, but you're not used to if you're normally playing on a pad or something like that. But otherwise, I don't find it that much different from if you've ever played a racing game before. You know, you're used to taking corners and taking wide and stuff like that. What's weirder is just the fact that buses are massive. Like, that's the thing that you don't... And if you've played Euro Truck Simulator, that's the closest comparison. You'll be kind of used to the idea. But then even with Euro Truck Simulator, there's a kind of... You can jackknife them because they are two distinct elements. The trailer on the back of you Can you pivot around that point? Where the bus doesn't, it's a single long entity. And so it's been like, I've had to relearn how to take corners in a way that you don't normally in games, that you gotta kind of veer away from the corner to give yourself enough width to turn without your back wheels clipping the curb as you go round. Which is kind of all really nerdy details of how to drive a bus in a video game. It doesn't seem particularly applicable to any other part of my life or video game knowledge.
What else have you been playing, Graham?
I've also been playing Quadriga, which is, I think, what it's called. Which is a turn-based chariot racing game. So there's a very different type of chariot to the buses I've just been talking about. But it is a game set in ancient Roman times, where you've got a little crew with your... If you do a career mode, then you get 3 drivers, 3 chariots, and 12 horses. And then you run races, and it's basically like FTL, and that you can name your 3 little guys, and so I've been playing it with Marsh, Chris, and Tom as my 3 guys, and you choose what faction you're part of as part of the kind of Roman Empire, and you choose what your starting city is. So I'm starting in Gaul, and then you build up your reputation by winning races, and you earn money by winning races, and then you pump that money into buying better chariots, better horses, better drivers. Or in my case, when you're very bad at the game, buying replacement horses, chariots, and drivers. And you kind of go on like that. And the actual races themselves are turn-based. So you start off at the starting line, and you have 2 options, one of which is accelerate, and one of which is whip, which is basically a faster version of accelerate, but you hurt your horses because you're whipping them quite hard. And then after that point, you get additional options, like veer left slightly, a medium amount, or a lot, or whip that guy to my right, or slam my chariot into that guy on my left. And then from there, it's that Sid Meier interesting series of decisions thing, where it's kind of cascading elements as you're on track with 3 or 7 other chariot racers trying to go as fast as possible without losing control in a bend and flipping over, trying to avoid attacks from your opponent drivers, trying to take them out of the race and deciding whether you're going to play aggressively, and trying to win and remain alive and with all your equipment and your horses intact, and then take that money and that skill and invest in skill points and stuff like that and grow from there. And so I've been playing it, and it's kind of like Skilletrics. So in the way that you kind of, if you go too fast on a bend, you'll flip over and stuff like that. So Chris, that's your specialty so far, is you've destroyed 2 of my 3 chariots by going too fast on bends. And at that point, your chariot gets just destroyed, but you don't get killed or anything. You're still hanging on to the reins, getting dragged behind the horses. And then at that point, your decision are twofold. You can either continue to hang on, because if the finish line is quite close, then you'll still cross the finish line and maybe you'll become 3rd or something like that. You'll get some money, so it's worth doing. Or you can bolt for the edge of the track. Now, the reason you do that is because if you come across some debris, like a broken chariot, then your horses will ride over it, and then you'll hit the debris and you'll be killed. Similarly, if you run for the edge of the track and there's a chariot coming along at that moment, then you will be killed. I should say that the turns kind of advance time by about 3 seconds each chunk, so you move about a little less than a quarter of the track, basically, each time you advance time. So if you decide to run for the side of the track, then there's a risk that if there's a chariot there, that it will reach you before you hit the side, and it will just crush you. Marsh, you're dead.
On
your first race, you whipped a horse, one of your horses, to death. Which was,
that's like me.
Because they've got health bars, and so you can make them go faster and faster and faster, but eventually, like, your little horsey just curled up in a fetal position on the track, creating an obstacle for everyone else there. But on the next race, your second race, in a bit of poetic justice, one of your rival racers whipped you, and you died. So
you just died from being whipped?
Whipped you a few times, and I guess you fell off, and you were killed, I'm afraid.
Thus always to tyrants, mind. Thus always to horse tyrants.
But at this point in the game, I'm down to 8 horses. I started with 12, and I've already had to replace 3 of them. So I've got,
have you replaced Marsh?
8. No, I don't have enough money to replace Marsh. So it's
irreplaceable,
just,
Chris.
It's just you and Tom that's left, and I only have 1 chariot, because you've destroyed 2 of them, and I bought another one, but then
so I destroyed 2 of them, but both times I successfully bolted, or did I ever cross the finish line on foot?
Both times you, one time you successfully bolted, 1 time you finished 3rd.
Excellent.
So you got that. Yeah. And see, and on the menu screen in between the races, you're making decisions like, who are you going to use in this next upcoming race? And one of your guys might be injured, and if you've got the money, you can pay to heal him. But it doesn't heal him immediately. It just basically sends him to a doctor. So on the next time around, he'll be better. You can choose to heal your horses as well based on the severity of their injuries and how much money you've got. But you can also do things like, well, what I'm having to do is take Tom's horses, because he doesn't need them, because he doesn't have a chariot anymore, because I had to give his chariot to you, and also giving him his horses now, basically.
Excellent. Which Tom is it, incidentally?
I didn't specify.
A Tom.
Yeah, just A Tom. This is an amalgamation of both of them. Francis Sr.
Yeah.
But it's great. It's just great. It's a turn-based chariot race.
That sounds
game,
awesome.
And
it really does sound awesome.
Creates little stories, and it's propelling level and curve in terms of you're becoming more powerful, your horses get faster, you're able to afford better horses. You can decide whether you want to be a kind of butch burly guy and slam into all your neighbouring opponents, or whether you want to maximise your agility and speed. And then within the matches, you're making all these little micro decisions that kind of, over the course of it, create this really dramatic, crashy racing game.
Is it a paid thing? Is it available now?
Or it is. It's built just by one guy in the Unity engine, but it's released by Slytherin / Matrix Games, who do a bunch of strategy titles and stuff like that. I'm not sure how much it is. I think it's only like 15 quid or something.
That's really good.
Shall we do questions for questions?
Yeah, why not? And I will read them out.
Do it, Chris.
Okay. Mike writes, "Dear Cretaceous and Cryogenians, in episode 32 you were discussing how you might turn something like surgery into a decent simulation, having undergone both angiography and atrial ablation, the former while fully awake, the latter while semi-conscious, which both involved the use of remote control catheters, 6-axis movement of patient and scanners, and massive fuck-off video display panels, which I think is actually the medical term for them. While my cardiologist was cracking jokes about wishing he could play Call of Duty on the setup, the only thing that genuinely scared me about the whole experience, I mean, Call of Duty, really? I'd be happy to say that these are opportunities for entertaining and realistic surgical simulations. Plus, I'd really like someone to take on Fantastic Voyage as a game, now that medical imaging is getting a lot closer to what was contemplated in that movie. Okay, maybe not an actual micro-miniature Raquel Welch, but I think we've lost a bit of the question. Shit. Okay, anyway, moving on. Which leads to my question. There have been any number of awful game adaptations of movies, novels, comics, and much smaller number of good ones, Lego, Star Wars, Riddick, etc. I'm sure you have your own favourite examples of good and bad, but I want to know what movies or novels should have been done well by now that haven't been. Thomas Flauses, which is, judging by the link in the email, the phrase, "Thanks for listening, everybody," felt through a John Travolta-themed name-mangling text generator. Mike. Les Mis. I think I might have said this before. Les Mis, the book or the musical or the film, whatever, as an Assassin's Creed-style open-world city game. But instead of assassinating people, you sing songs and furtively fall in love during a period of social unrest in, 18th century Paris.
We can make this happen.
I dreamed a dream, Marsh.
Yeah. Well, maybe that should be the next target for our game jam.
That's my dream Assassin's Creed game, to be honest. Like, Desmond gets into the Animus, and then he is, fucking, I don't know, Marius or someone. Maybe not.
24601?
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the subject 13, subject 12, subject 11, subject 24601. It'd be fucking great. I'd love that game. Does anyone have anything better than that?
No.
Okay. We'll move on then. Thanks, Mike. That's the perfect question for me. Joss from York writes, "Dear Crep and Cowbell, Inspired by a comment on the most recent episode, what is the best rant you have ever written that you decided not to publish? For 150 extra points, if you still have it somewhere, bring it in and read it to the group. I hope you'll find catharsis in this exercise, although I fear it is more likely that you'll just rekindle the flames of a fire once burnt out. Thanks for reading, everybody. Joss from York. I'd like to point out, I think creative spelling of thanks for reading, everybody, is the new Crate and Crowbar pun.
See, I voted for this one, but only because I wanted to hear what yours was, because I saw that you voted for it.
So, mine is everything I've ever written about games journalism.
Yeah.
I've steadfastly, I've written loads.
Oh, see, not about games, you mean
about games journalism. Right.
Games journalism,
Yeah, games journalism, journalism, which I think is a terrible thing for anybody to partake in, should be discouraged in youngsters, but, a lot of times when there's been these big industry-wide standards crises or dramas or whatever, I hate Twitter arguments, so I would always prefer to write something. And I have written things, written thousands of words about this stuff, just about how I feel about it, but every single time I think I made the entirely correct decision, which is to never, ever, under any circumstances, publish it.
Yeah, I've done that as well, to be honest. Put that in a little folder within Google Docs and never ever look at it ever again.
Yeah, it's useful, but it's a great way of passing an angry train journey, writing a little manifesto, but never under any circumstances believe that you're important enough to post it for an audience. Yeah, I think that'd probably be mine. I did make, the only thing I regret not having run with, actually, because I never finished it, was I did make a Twine game about arguing about games journalism on Twitter, which is a Twine game that was impossible to win. And it wasn't, you weren't like writing specific responses, you were only choosing an emotional or a style of response to a particular side in an argument, etc. And inevitably you would find yourself relegated to the point of pointless yes man for someone else's campaign, or ignored, opinionated, idiosyncratic nothing, or a bunch of other kind of pretty miserable ways to end up. All variants on a theme. That's the only one that I regret not doing. The reason is because it was at least built in a spirit of fun rather than contributing another earnest manifesto to the world.
Didn't you post a kind of image, Thurston's axes?
I did actually make a compass. Yeah. That's the only thing I've ever actually done and finished. And that's because I think I was talking to you, Marsh, about it in the pub. And it made someone laugh at the time, so I decided to actually do it, which is a compass with, about to help you locate games journalists on a compass with style on one axis, which goes from just the facts to I'm a poet, and subject matter on the other axis, which goes from indie sued to industry shill, and that basically covers everyone. Like everyone's on there somewhere.
Yep.
Eric Frieden writes. He says, just roll with it, you won't do it right anyway, in reference to the pronunciation of his name, so sorry if I got that wrong. I come from Sweden, and I'm starting to recognise some shared characteristics of the games that come out of my home country, which has got me interested in national characteristics in games. And he goes on to ask, what makes a game British? What is the quintessential Swedish game? Talking about the best way that national identity is expressed through game design.
It's interesting, like, I can't remember if they were ever implemented now, but there was a suggestion that British games would get a tax break for being not only made in Britain, but espousing British qualities, whatever that means, which led to suggestions that, you know, games should include Milton Mowbray pork pies and lots of tea and other kind of crass, stereotypical British things. I don't think, actually, those are the things that make British games that are identified to be British. I think there was a period, probably in the 90s, where the actual practices of British game development were different from elsewhere in the world. And the games that came out of that were slightly shambolic, probably, but they had ambitions, which was hobbled by the need to try and make these unwieldy projects into a coherent whole. But you could see kind of elements of brilliance in them. I think that's the kind of thing that typifies, there's a certain kind of feel to the Lionhead, or even prior to that, Bullfrog kind of feeling of those games, which you didn't get elsewhere in the world. I think that's been totally overturned now, though, because the entire industry has changed the way it practices. And indie development is a much bigger thing, so you don't have quite the same sense, I don't think.
I wonder how much of it is a kind of sense of humour more than anything else, because, like, with some countries, you can kind of point to a particularly dominant genre. Certainly with Swedish or German, you can point to stuff like adventure games and grand strategy games are particularly defining. But I find it difficult with the UK when you've got everything from the kind of Bullfrog stuff to Jeff Minter's stuff to DMA design stuff to James Bond RoboCod, and, you know, like, because of the Commodore Amiga and that sort of stuff, there was such a vibrant development scene. But the thing that there is a kind of a tone to, I think, as you said, Lionhead type stuff and the Bullfrog type stuff before that, and relatedly, you know, Charles Cecil type stuff, which is, I think,
or even rare
British.
Even RuneScape, to be honest. Like, I mean, Jagex is a huge British developer that doesn't get spoken about very much. You know, that had the same kind of Pratchett-y fantasy thing that was common. I was going to say, I think maybe there is some sort of national expression, but it's mostly because good games are a product more often than not of strong, you know, artistic statements being made well, and that will express itself in different ways based on sort of culture at the time. I grew up in Liverpool, and when I used to think about what British games were like, other games weren't. Bear in mind, I'm too young, sorry if people listen to this, for, like, the Spectrum. Or, like, that, you know, my first computer was an Amiga 1200. But I always think of, like, Wipeout. I think of games that were really cool, that were, like, designed, like, not just mechanically, but visually, like, well-designed in the way that a cool album cover would be. That were the first games to make the connection between games and dance music and games and sort of that kind of culture that, I mean, I was just too young for dance music, but nonetheless sort of understood why that was cool, and that was really appealing, like that kind of spirit of games having a bit of edge to them, that was not, you know, because of violence or anything, but was because of a kind of really focused look and feel, which for me, at least at the time, obviously Japanese games had a hugely, you know, huge identity of their own. And so did American games to an extent, but they tended to me to seem more obvious in a way that Wipeout, for example, didn't. It wasn't metal and, you know, it wasn't heavy metal and, you know, traditional video game sci-fi tropes. It was something that felt distinctly its own thing, which for me was a very British thing at the time. And the only, I think, modern successor to that would be, even though it was hated by a lot of people, the way Ninja Theory rethought Devil May Cry. I think even though that game is set in sort of fantasy America and has sort of American characters, there's something quite punkish and particularly British punk about the way it kind of reconfigures that universe around, you know, the biggest demon being basically a banker and that kind of thing. Doesn't necessarily feel like it would have come out in another culture. But to be honest, I do think that trying to divide these things down national lines is less useful than defining them down particular places and times. And, you know, Liverpool was a cool place in the 90s, as was Manchester.
It would have been much more true in the past when just the lack of internet events that you couldn't more easily, you know, your workforces were more likely to be siloed in a single country. Whereas that's not really the case at all now. Like, I mean, GTA won awards at the BAFTA, but, you know, that, although a lot of it was made in Scotland, certainly not solely made in Scotland. It's, I mean, I'm sure they use the development teams they have all over the world to produce GTA 5.
Rar, it's Godzilla, that took a while, writes, Dear Top Gear.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Which one's James May out of us? Let's not point fingers, actually.
We want to keep doing this podcast from now on. I actually say to new writers in the office now that the best barometer to figure out whether a joke or a caption or something is funny in the magazine is if you read it in a Jeremy Clarkson voice, does it sound like something he would say? If so, remove it and yourself. Joking aside, he clarifies, I recently finished the painful and gruesome Ways to Die simulator that was Tomb Raider. As I headed into the final battle, I was surprised to find that I have done the game on normal difficulty. This is something new to me, and I am regularly mocked for playing games on the easiest difficulty. I find this is the best way to get what I want from games, namely a story. On easy mode, I'm not frustrated nor get angry during my relaxing time. Hearts of Iron is great for this, with the true hardcore play on the hardest mode. Maybe this is why I'm not so good at multiplayer games, especially FPSs, as there is only one difficulty, really. Battlefield, Red Orchestra, and Counter-Strike are an exercise of futility and unawareness for me. Therein lies the question. Do you prefer to play games in the easiest modes for a tale or to finish it, and to finish it? Or do you think the beauty of a game lies in the effort you must put in to beat it? Dark Souls is therefore a game I am terrified of. Goodbye! Right, Godzilla, who is from the forums.
I think it varies for me hugely. Most games I play on normal difficulty level the first time around, but I have certainly with single player first person shooters where I'm there just to experience the world more than anything else. I've plopped it on easy just to have a nice time running through a story or running through a place or looking at the pretty visuals, especially if it's a game I don't suspect I'm going to enjoy very much. And there are a lot of games, Remember Me is one example, where it didn't get very good reviews, but it looks fucking beautiful because it's set in this kind of new Paris thing, and the world design's astonishing, and I kind of want to run through it and see about it. That I don't really want to have to engage too much with mechanics I don't like, and often easy mode just lets you breeze past bits of combat that might otherwise be tedious, or boss fights that might otherwise be tedious. Similarly, though, I sometimes put a game on hard modes, stuff like Far Cry 2, for example, is a suddenly very different and much better game for the challenge and the threat of being near death a lot of the time if you fuck up and stop being stealthy and just charge in the way you can in easier modes.
Yeah. I agree.
Strong opinions, that's what we've got. We're on the normal level for opinions.
I'm hard, always. Oh, hi. I said that wrong. Speaking is difficult. shit. So, I definitely had a shift in my behaviour in my late teens, maybe? When I went from that kind of attitude to always playing the hardest setting available. And if a game has multiple difficulty settings that are unlocked over time, I'll try and get as far as I can. I suddenly found that the value I was getting out of games came from difficulty. And that's a thread that ran through every kind of game experience I wanted to get. I wanted my multiplayer games to be difficult and demand mastery, which is probably why I ended up sticking with Dota, to go back to an earlier conversation. But even in the opposite case, I found that difficulty done well hugely helped with plot. And, you know, I've spoken on the podcast many times about Mass Effect and how much that series has meant to me. I tweeted this week about how I don't think I'll ever love a series much like I love that again. I think I'm not too old to fall in love with the single-player game narrative in that way. But when I played those games, I would always play them on the hardest possible setting, and I've replayed all of them multiple times and, worked in Mass Effect 1 to beat all of the challenge stages on insane difficulty with an infiltrator, which is supposed to be the hardest thing to do in that game. And I've done all of it. And the reason for that, for me, is that a drum will bang until someone fixes it about games. The stakes for your character are a part of the plot. They absolutely are part of the experience of playing that game. And if combat isn't a challenge, then it will, and fuck it, I'm gonna say it, ludonarrative dissonance, it affects your investment in the things that are happening to the person that you are in the story. Like, that, for me, is a kind of a bottom line. Mm. So, when I came to play Mass Effect 3 for the first time, knowing that I was only going to have one shot at playing a game I've been waiting for years, and a story I really cared about, knowing that I'd only have one chance to play it for the first time, I absolutely had no choice but to play on the hardest setting. Because even though it might demand a bit more trial and error in getting through some combat sections or whatever, all of those fights and that conclusion and everything involved in getting to the end of that game would be more meaningful to me for being more difficult. And, I actually probably wouldn't have been able to forgive myself for playing on an easier setting. Because it would have meant less to me. Like, those, you know, climactic battles when you're, you know, coming towards the end mean something because they are hard.
Mm. See, I think, I maybe come to it from a similar place in that when I start a game I really care about, I want the most authentic version of that experience, but that's often what drives me towards normal as a starting point, because normal is often the way a game was designed. That's the kind of base experience, and then they ramp some stuff up for hard mode and ramp it back down for easy mode. And it's the kind of, I think of it in terms of sometimes Easy Mode is the abridged version of a book that you know, mm-hmm. that you really like. And I don't want to listen to the abridged version of an audiobook because it feels cheating. It feels inauthentic in some way. Like I'm not getting the full experience. If it's an experience that parts of that I want to skip, then I go for Easy Mode. But similarly, like, I don't go for Hard Mode because that trial and error seems counter to often the legitimate experience because you're dying and reloading so often, and it can, I mean, it depends very much on the game. Does. It's very hard to generalize, but a lot of games, less so now, their Hard Mode just becomes a kind of trudge of everyone takes 4 bullets to kill instead of 2 and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you have to trust that the designers know how to make a Hard Mode which is convincing.
To an extent, although I would argue that I think one of the reasons for that trend in my own behaviour is that games have gotten a lot easier. Yeah, just in that period. And maybe I would have wanted to play on normal because normal would have been an acceptable challenge. Like, I think maybe, a good case in point for this would be, Halo, the Halo series. I'm going to talk about console games for a little bit because back when this change happened, I didn't have a gaming PC, so I was playing on Xbox 360. And I got into Gears of War and I got into Halo. And I hadn't played those kinds of games for a while, so initially normal mode was enough. But as both of those series continued, thinking really about, like, Halo 3 through to Reach, and Gears 1 through to Gears 3, my difficulty level went steadily up and up and up and up because the mode that I felt challenged at got harder, partly because I was getting better at them, partly because I think games themselves were getting more forgiving. Like, the earlier Halo games are substantially less forgiving on normal than the later ones are, and that's not really an accident, that's because of general trends in game design. But for me, the meaningful experience comes when I feel genuinely under threat in a situation, like, given that 90% of the games we talk about are about conflict of some kind, the counterpoint, I think, to the, well, hard isn't really what the developers intended argument is that, on the other hand, fighting is hard. And the developers want you to have a nice time, but the story is probably going to be about people having a bad time, because that's what stories tend to be about. The
story is also about people succeeding, right? Eventually, and presumably the experience of those characters is not that they reload, and it's not that they spend a lot of their time feeling slightly bored and cheesed off, which is sometimes the experience if you kind of have to kind of just grind and grind and grind at a level until you complete it. Like, so I totally do see what you're getting at, but there has to be balanced against the ludonarrative dissonance you get from having a cakewalk. It has to be balanced against the fact that maybe you're not actually experiencing the narrative or the meaning of that story properly if you're constantly reloading.
I think this is where it really does come down to personal preference. For me, I find failing and reloading less immersion-breaking than going too quickly. And that's, like, I sometimes get a feeling, and it's like a gut thing. If I start playing an RPG, and I'm not picking up the incidental details, like, you know how you when you watch a lot of films, especially, like, complicated films, you learn to actually watch as opposed to it's the difference between skim reading and reading. There's almost some such thing as skim watching, which is what you can do, like, with a TV show in a window while you do something else. But some things demand, a level of investment. And if you miss something, you kind of know that you have to go back and listen to it. Same with podcasts, actually. Some podcasts you can kind of have chuntering on in the background, which someone certainly is doing now. This has got kind of meta and weird for you. And some you actually really have to pay attention to, or you miss something, you have to backtrack. Games are like that as well. And in some games, if you go too fast, you miss the things that make those games great, which is points about environmental detail, pacing, tone, whatever.
You disengage a little bit, and you're just focused on the sense of progress. Just get to the next bit. Oh, this isn't worth me thinking about because it's so easy.
Yeah,
so
and if the game obliges you, that sort of that slippery slope gets slipperier and slipperier until you miss everything. And so it's not even just the experience of combat that suffers. The whole experience suffers for being frictionless. And for me, even if I'm frustrated or even a little bit bored replaying the same boss fight over and over again, really trying to crack it. And I think maybe the Mass Effect example is a bad one because I became so good at that game from replaying it so many times that it's not that much of a challenge regardless. It still has a kind of friction to it that forces me to pay attention on my 7th playthrough, which, like, is what makes it interesting. I'm not interested in just sliding past an experience I've had a dozen times. I'm interested in, like, feeling as close to getting it fresh again as I can get. And within playing something for the first time, I want it to feel as fresh as it can possibly be. And for me, that means being forced to constantly pay attention, which is what hard difficulty does.
Yeah, I think some games manage that without They just manage to provide you with an interesting set of mechanics to play with. And you can do interesting things with them, regardless of the actual kind of raw difficulty that you're facing. If you're making a lot of choices that you have to be consciously aware of the whole time,
perhaps
that engages you in a different way.
I think maybe also I'm capable of over-investing in the beats of narrative to such an extent that I can see meaning in, well, in this particular version of the fight, I took cover with this person, and in this version of the fight, I took cover with that character. And that, for me, means something.
Actually, the Halo games are a really good example of this, because they do become really gratifyingly completely different tactical games when on the harder difficulties.
They become themselves, really, higher games. I think if you'd ever understand why, like I, for example, fucking love those games and think they're amazing, it's because at high difficulties they are, I think, some of the best strategic, but not in the sense that people often mean strategic, shooters ever made. But it's not apparent on normal, where it is just a game of blasting little cute aliens that go blah.
I think Far Cry 2 is the same thing. And I think even things like respawning enemies, when you make the game difficult and you make it about constantly being under threat and constantly not having enough resources, and it justifies a lot of decisions, like the fact that your guns break so frequently becomes just a part of that narrative of how fucking punishing and horrible this environment is, and the fact that every enemy you meet is so deadly makes it interesting when you come to a checkpoint, because it's not just a simple time-wasting thing of, oh, I'm getting to A to B, and these kind of time-wasting obstacles that aren't really challenging, I just gotta kill them again for another fucking time, and I know I can do that, it's gonna be easy. No, this is actually frightening now, because these guys are really difficult, and you're gonna go out your way to drive around this checkpoint and go through the brush and stuff.
Steve writes, and this is a long one, but I think it's actually quite a nice story, so I'm going to get through it. Greetings, Crowbards. This is a sad email, for I'm sad. It's also rather long, for which I apologise. The reason for my sadness is probably middle-aged, damp-faced, and slightly drunk nostalgia. The best kind. It's also been caused by my enjoyment of your excellent podcast. Thank you. I'm always cheered by the arrival of the new Crate and Crowbar. It's a pub I'd like to drink in, and that makes me sad. Why? Because I don't get to play games the old way anymore. The four wasted guys in the student living room way. The 10 drunk after-party goers, mushroom-fueled Echo the Dolphinites, talking about games way. They really ought to be reading some more Jane Austen, but hey, one more sensible soccer can't hurt, can it, way. The Micro Machines way, the Super Skid Marks way, and later the Subspace way, the Total Annihilation way. It goes on and on, from the Spectrum days of yore to PC gaming. And he goes on to sort of explain this sort of faded for him, getting married and having kids, etc., etc. The question I wanted to ask was about Zap 64. When I was young, that was Crate and Crowbar, followed later by other computer mags, White Dwarf, etc., etc. Furtively bought teenage geek sinks, which, thinking about it, should probably be something you can add to a mech. Those magazines were community, they were acceptance, and sometimes even a channel for your thoughts if you were lucky enough to have a letter printed. You guys all know this, since most of you do or did just that thing. The best ones worked because they found the right way to walk the knife edge of stupid and informative advertising and editorial. They knew their audience, and they spoke to them as best they could. They were friends, they were the hobby, the lobby, the forum, and they were the thing that the internet's kind of replaced today. What makes me sad is, with no time to invest in new games and an internet that consists largely of fucking idiots, there's really not much sense of community or opportunity to play the kind of social games that used to require several wasted people slumping around in a room. Not when you've got shits to do, kids to bring up, and so on. So my actual question is, do you guys do the Crate and Crowbar out some kind of similar understanding of the need and want for that stuff, the sitting around talking about games thing, the playing together thing, the community thing, or just because you're mates? And given that, by working in the industry, and thinking about your comments recently re the San Fran scene and games that require the old way of doing things, do you think multiplayer has actually suffered from the internet? In some ways, isn't Monopoly better? Sorry for, well, all that. Keep creating those crowbars. Steve. It's quite a lot of questions in that. I mean, we've already spoken about how local multiplayer games like Towerfall and Nidhogg and so on are back in a way that makes that kind of drunk friends sitting around playing one game accessible again to at least certain groups of people in a way that maybe it went away for a while. Like, after this, we're going to go play Gang Beasts and that'll be fun.
I think there's a kind of gravitational pull to the internet, which has made certain experiences convenient, and in so doing, kind of overwritten a bunch of other slightly less convenient but similar experiences, if that makes any sense. Because he talks about the fact that, you know, the internet has replaced a lot of these things, but not really. And the internet's full of fucking idiots, as he puts it, which I mostly agree with. But that needn't be the case. And there are places where gamers meet up together to do things, and certainly there are other hobbies where people continue to create social groups around them and do a much better job of kind of enacting their hobbies in the real world. I mean, I used to live opposite Victoria Park in Bath, and you would look out the window on a weekend and there would be people there with model airplanes and stuff like that, meeting up in the park to do that stuff together, and there is no reason why, as an adult, you can't continue to create those social experiences you had when they were easier, when you lived as a student. Or certainly I hope that having kids and a wife doesn't override them, remove those things. In terms of why we created the podcast, certainly part of the motivation for me was I was leaving PC Gamer and I wanted to maintain that social group for as long as I could and continue to be a part of these kinds of discussions. Maybe that'll all go away if I have kids.
I mean, I think the circumstances of the way that gaming particularly exists in people's lives have changed substantially, like especially in the timescale that he's talking about. Like, that is it is a significant change. Those groups do exist, but the circumstances in which things happen, there are vastly more options. And in some ways that's a good thing, and sometimes it actually separates people as each person makes their own choice about where they're going to invest their time. I don't think the impetus has changed. Like, it's the same kind of impulse that makes people feel attached to a magazine, this makes them feel attached to a YouTube channel or a YouTuber or a Twitch streamer or whatever it is that the kids are watching these days on their dad's iPads. And as someone who's a magazine, which is part of the previous generation of things that did that, I think it's still very important. But it's not necessarily something that separates magazines from anything else. Like, I think magazines are particularly good at fostering a sense of a community because they are particularly good at showcasing individual creativity in a way that websites aren't, in my opinion. But that's not to say that the same need isn't met in other ways. And so to kind of lament the fall of an entire form, I think, is probably the wrong thing to do. The best way to think about it is that the kids today who are 12 years old and getting into games and looking for a voice to guide them through it and a sense of community around their hobby are finding it from YouTubers and so on, not necessarily from the old guard. And that's maybe a shame. It's a shame for me, but, like, you know, it is the way things change. As for doing this, I mean, partly it was because I wanted it to exist for broadly those reasons. I think doing this creates a really strong sense of community. The strength of the forums has pretty much proved that. So
I kind of just want this guy to go out and create a group, a gaming group for you. If he's got gaming friends, just go do it. And if he doesn't have gaming friends, then maybe it's a case of having to walk into his nearest Games Workshop and buy some paint. But these things still exist, and these things can still be made, and I wish there were people making more of them.
Yeah, the world's a bigger place than it was, but it doesn't mean these things don't happen. Actually, and if this question didn't come from the forum, this guy should totally sign up on the forum. Because the forum is a great way of getting some of that old vibe.
Full of fucking idiots.
And it's not full of fucking idiots. Magic Keyboard writes, "Greetings, gents. Let me start by saying that I absolutely love the podcast and listen to every episode, including the old podcast. Now, with that out of the way, on numerous podcasts, you've voiced your disapproval over the portrayal of women in video games. While I certainly agree that women are portrayed poorly, my question for you is this. Why does it matter?"
He does go
easy,
on to explain
easy voice.
This, but yeah.
Do you believe that the content of video games has the ability to influence people's behaviour in real life? You must. Otherwise, you wouldn't care how women or men, for that matter, are portrayed in them. Which leads me to my next question. Why don't you also disapprove of extreme violence in video games? Why is it right to show graphic murders and take lethal pleasure in executing them, but wrong to stereotype women? In my mind, both are very bad things and should be equal recipients of disapproval. Are you making inconsistent moral judgments, or are you simply voicing an opinion regarding what you like, violence, and don't like, sexism? I would love to hear what you have to say. Thanks for drinking, everybody. With love, Magic Keyboard.
As much as I do like violence, I tend to think that actually I do disapprove of games which depict violence in a way which relates closely or supports violence in the real world. I do think that's immoral. So I have lots of qualms about games with modern warfare settings, which at least depict or possibly advocate the mass killing of people with torture and things like that. So I wouldn't put it on an equivalent with... The thing about that is that in most cases, violence is to some extent abstracted, or it's placed in a fantasy setting, and it is also illegal in reality. So there is a kind of disconnect there, where there is...
They're not equivalent actions. Like, this is the thing. Yeah. Like, the thing that's really important, I think, to maintain, and the thing that unpicks this purported hypocrisy, is the idea that of symbolic actions, right? There is such a thing as symbolic violence, which is a pretty much a facet in every form of human culture, which is what video games enact, and that people have their own relationship with. And symbolic violence is a very crucially very different thing from real violence. And sometimes there are fine lines between the two in certain areas.
Whereas misogyny in games is not symbolic. It's
misogyny is just misogyny.
Yeah.
And so there's no such thing as symbolic misrepresentation of women. It is just simply misrepresentation of women. There is a one-to-one correlation between the way the game regards or implicitly regards half of the species, and the way that those same attitudes are expressed in other problematic ways in quote-unquote real life, in a way that simply isn't the case for violence. You know, the existence of, abstract's one way of putting it, but I think symbolic is a useful way.
Yeah, it's a much better word to use.
Because it's like, you know, it's not like the games, I do not believe, really teach people to be violent. You know, I don't think they give you the instruction to be violent, maybe except in some very, very, very edge cases. And they don't encourage violence necessarily as a good thing or a thing that you could go out and do. Except maybe in some very sort of, in some real world cases. We've spoken before about distaste for modern military settings for this reason, that it brings, it sort of devalues a historical context that is quite important for people to take seriously. But I do believe that people could internalize the way that women are portrayed in games and expect real women to adhere to those patterns and behaviors. And I think that is, you know, that is not as much of a leap as it is to say that someone playing Call of Duty is necessarily then going to go on and be violent. Like, they're much closer to each other just in terms of how those actions are constructed, because one is a symbol for a physical thing, and the other is a symbol of functionally also a symbolic it's a process that exists in people's heads either way, so therefore it's something that's more easily transmitted.
Violence is also tied to mechanics. It's tied to a particular problem that you're solving within the game, so it's also quite specific. Whereas I don't think there's a game where you're successful by virtue of your misogyny.
Yeah.
That's just kind of window dressing.
If there is violence in a game, it's because that game is about war normally. It's not normalizing that behavior in regular society in the way that you could say that it is when it's misogyny, because it's not a game about misogyny or sexism or anything like that. So that's not the heroic act that you're committing, which means it's not encouraged, but it's just treated like normal behavior. And when so much of our media is on TV and film and similar, whereas, as you pointed out, violence is a crime. You know, there's a pretty strong indicator in the real world that you're not supposed to do that thing, where there's not necessarily with debasing language.
And other industries are making, you know, positive steps, as are games in some ways, towards addressing just a problem with representation. That it limits the size of the potential audience. It you know, makes it more difficult for games to stand up seriously among other forms of culture whenever people fail to meet a standard that society holds, at least hopefully most of the time, for how entertainment functions. Like, you know, standards change and games have to keep up with that, and appealing to 13-year-old boys isn't the way to progress in any way, shape, or form.
It's worth noting that just how much we internalize this stuff without realizing it. There's a really interesting post by the creators of, is it Desktop Dungeons? And they wrote a post about their female goblin design, and their intent was to create a bunch of female character designs that eschewed kind of the kind of sexist cliches of video game character design, but they still found it quite difficult and challenging to do because a bunch of
what does a female goblin look like?
Yeah, and because they'd internalized a bunch of their standards of like what is good character design was based on all this media they'd consumed over years and years, and so even with the best of intents, they found it a challenging process, and it's really interesting post to see them kind of work through that and overcome base assumptions and reach further and do a better job as a result of it. And so when you get like a development team of even 200 people, if there's not a woman in the room when a decision is made, or that woman's not in a position of significant power where she can feels like she can speak up, a bunch of really well-meaning people can still be unintentionally sexist or unintentionally racist without even noticing that they're doing it.
They were trying to create some way of signing that a goblin was female, but all the ways that they did that were to kind of fall back on kind of cliche forms of signing femininity, like having fluttering eyelashes or lipstick. And obviously they said that this wasn't acceptable to themselves, but it does kind of, it's a tricky problem to get around.
It's the Miss Pac-Man thing, which is kind of like a...
Put a bow on it.
Yeah, put a bow on it, which is kind of like, gets scorned as a criticism because it's only Pac-Man. But at the same time, it is a pretty good example of the extent to which we internalize these things without realizing it.
It'll be a really brave game. I was thinking about, it took ages, in this case, in Mass Effect's case, it took ages for Mass Effect to invent female equivalents to a lot of its alien races, apart from the Asari, who are all female. And interestingly, if you ever read the art stuff they did around that, the Asari originally looked much, much more alien. They were female, technically, or in some sort of broader sense, but they looked much, much more alien. And in order to try and make them attractive to the player, they had to dial it back, and dial it back, and dial it back, and they kept dialing it back until their faces were more or less human. They originally had very different eyes and noses and mouths and things, and then they realized that there was nothing you could change about the sort of human-female face if they wanted this, with this, I think, mistaken end goal that they had to be attractive to humans. But then when they went to design the Turian females and the Krogan females and the Quarian females and so on, actually, no, Quarian females were in from the start, so ignore that one. It went the other way around. They had to design Quarian males. They, in every case, fell on kind of like, you know, human ideas of femininity. So female Turians are more slender and more feminine, basically. And female Krogan are kind of the exception because they do just look like Krogan. But even then, it shies away from going more... quote-unquote, masculine. Whereas in the animal kingdom, for example, there's plenty of precedents for females being substantially larger than the males of their species or whatever, and I'd love to see the game that just goes in that direction without going in the monster direction, where it's not just like, oh god, it's a fucking spider queen, which is the alternate. games can do one or the other. They can do sexy monster or spider queen.
Dark Souls is a sexy spider queen.
That's because it's way ahead of the game. No, but what I mean is, there's a cool alternate dimension where they decided that the female Turians in Mass Effect were just bigger and butcher than the male Turians, and that would be completely fine from Victor Pudding.
Wildstar had this problem recently, and they're revising some of their female character designs for exactly this purpose. But it's a game where all the races are aliens, and some of the...
Possibly humans.
Apart from the humans, good point. But all of the males in it are allowed to kind of better express the defining traits of that race. And so there's a race of kind of these British rock people who are meant to be like really ugly and hideous looking, but then the female version of it has kind of...
Like, how do we make this leaves. Rock hot?
Yeah.
Hot rocks, we'll call it.
Well, I'm sure that wasn't the first thing they wrote at the top of their whiteboard. Like, I want to believe that they went into it with the best of intents, but their kind of art style, their cartoony art style, the way in which you identify this person being a woman is a bunch of secondary sexual characteristics which require and slope down towards badness.
Yeah, exactly.
Bad tropes.
Yeah,
it's really interesting.
It's bad, and because it's a artistic failing of games when it's done inappropriately, and that's why we keep bringing it up, I think. That's why it's separate to the violence issue in a way, because representations of violence can be abstract or realistic or whatever, and we'll have problems with them on a case-by-case basis, but, you know, particularly the portrayal of women is so reliably something that games just fall back on the same old ideas to portray, as every other media, that of course you should kick back at it.
I don't think that's violence off the hook, though. I do think there is filling your life with violence and noise probably has a kind of normalizing effect on that as well. And that's
we have criticized violence on this podcast as well. Like, the question suggests that we haven't, but we spoke at length either last episode or two episodes ago about Rainbow Six Patriots, and part of that wasn't just the press X to life. It was, it was the callous disregard for human life at the end, where the heroic act is to throw the character, the normal civilian with a bomb trapped around them, off a bridge.
Hmm.
And there is just like a kind of, there's a callous disregard for human life in that game. And Ubisoft have been guiltier of it than most. I think we also spoke E3 last year or 2 years ago, where the sheer number of blades going through people's necks.
Oh yeah,
absurd.
Yeah.
Every single game.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to let violence off the hook necessarily, but I think violence, for example, people feel freer to just experiment wildly with what, you know, constitutes it. You wouldn't necessarily say that, you know, you could have a meaningful discussion about violence in Devil May Cry compared to, you know, violence in a modern military shooter, for example, or in Armor or something.
Yeah, because, they're very asymmetrical.
You know, I do think that violent conflict is a pretty fundamental human thing in storytelling. Like, it's, you know, maybe that's something bad about us, but it's nothing to do with games. Like, you know, the first fucking work in English literature has a guy rip a monster's arm off and hang it above a door. Like, there's no, you know, this is not new, and it's not, you know, but the idea that, you know, women have to be curvy is something that we can do something about and should be expressed with more diversity. Ironically, violence is almost the model, because violence is expressed with a tremendous diversity and creative range in a way that it simply isn't attributed to female character design.
Yeah. And after this podcast is finished, I'm going to probably feed both of you into a mincing machine in Gang Beasts, but we'll be playing this kind of silly jelly baby thing, so it'll be fine.
Yeah. Silly, genderless jelly baby things. That's the future. Ronan O'Keefe writes, "Dear Baffled Crates and Sorry Crowbars, a few episodes ago you sent Tom Francis into the world of Abandonware to play covert action. You might be interested to know that there's a similar game called Liberal Crime Squad. You must stop the conservatives, burn flags, and spray paint your tag all over the walls. It's good fun, Ronan."
It's appropriate that question follows the last one.
Mean that. Welcome to the Liberal Crime Squad. No, just thought I'd read that out because it's a good recommendation. We can put a link in the show notes. Yeah. Also, I love the phrase "liberal crime squad."
Good phrase.
It should be. I don't know. It should be something. I don't know what that necessarily is. A rap group, a band, a Twitter list.
That sounds like something like Bill O'Reilly would have said at some point on Fox News.
Liberal crime groups, etc., etc. Yeah. Bad asks, how awesome would Kitchen Unit Simulator 2014 be? Discuss. And this is in reference to a recent spate of kitchenware spam on the forum, where not bots, but I suspect humans, SEO-hunting humans, have been posting links to various regional UK furniture and kitchenware sales on our forum. I today banned a bunch of people, deleted a bunch of threads, and so couldn't actually delete some of the threads because people's responses to it were really funny. And so I didn't want to lose like 2 pages of golden comedy based on one person's links to like a fucking DIY sale in Hull. So I actually left the thread but banned the user. So if they're still there, that's why, because they're funny. So if you want me to delete them, just stop being funny. that'd be good. Interestingly, my job used to involve, my old job used to involve seeding, links to businesses who would pay for a certain amount of, like, referral links throughout the internet. My old Reddit account for my new one is just fucking links to people who sell window blinds. So, I feel a little bit sorry for whoever's having to sign up to our forum to post links to,
I wonder if they got any sales through it.
Probably not, but, you know, hey, it's more about Google. It's more about having referrals from a variety of different sources. But because of that, I don't think it's necessarily a bot problem, therefore we should be able to get on top of it, at least.
And that's all the time we have
for questions
and for podcasts. If you'd like to send in some of your own questions, you can do so by emailing us. Send them to questions@CratonCrowbar.com, or you can find us on the Twitters @CratonCrowbar, or you can find us individually on the Twitters. I am at Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
I'm at Marsh Davis, which is D-A-V-I-E-S.
And I'm at C. Thurston, which is C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E, like in Martin's name, but a different name, E-N.
Very good spelling, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody!
Shall we take a break? Shall we take a break? Break.